I'd like to introduce Dr. Gerald Edelman. He is a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, director of the Neurosciences Institute, professor at the Scripps Research Institute, and chairman of the Department of Neurobiology there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. So you work with theories of mind and brain and intelligence and consciousness, and the understanding of any of these is done through the use of metaphors and analogies. What were the metaphors for mind when you started doing your research, and how have they changed in the era of computers and the internet?
May I start the answer to that question by going back into empirical science rather than talking about metaphor right away?
Okay.
Well, what we would like to do, for example, at the Neurosciences Institute and neurosciences in general, ultimately, I believe, is to understand how the human brain works, how it takes account of perception, of memory, of consciousness itself. And that requires a very broad range of subdisciplines of science to look into all the aspects from the molecular aspect all the way on up to behavior and everything in between. And of course, one of the most important things is to take account of evolution. How did our brain evolve to do what it does? And so I would prefer to start from there and then move on and say, yes, there are metaphors for how the brain works, but they're very dangerous in a way, because a metaphor is in general a bad theory. It's very useful, but it doesn't help you in a precise scientific mode. Right. So my own work is related to the fundamental molecular processes inside the brain, inside nerve cells. It's also, of course, very much interested in developing theories of how the brain works. The brain is unique in that sense as a biological object because, of course, it gives rise to everything we know about epistemology, consciousness, etc. And therefore, you do need a theory. So the other aspect of my work relates to building a global brain theory. That is a brain theory that will explain in evolutionary and physical terms how the brain gives rise to perception and memory and ultimately to consciousness.
Should we start with the evolutionary theory?
Well, yes. All theories must take account of Charles Darwin, whose birthday, by the way, the 200th anniversary has been celebrated this year in many, many places.
Right.
And the idea is that clearly brains come in many, many flavors. The nerve cells of the brain are very ancient cells. You'll see them in small insects. You'll see them in worms. You'll see them in mammals. You'll finally see them in human beings. And there is a line to be traced in all of these cases according to Darwin's theory of evolution. And so it is important that if you formulate a brain theory, that it be consistent with his theory. It cannot be inconsistent. It cannot be, for example, simply computerology or the idea of using logic and a clock and a computer to explain the brain. You have to really look at the neural structures and the way they operate with each other.
And so how do you do that? How do you actually study the way the brain evolved?
Well, what you do, of course, in the case of evolution, is you study exemplars that are available from the historical and paleontological record. But you also look at different species. And you, of course, do not hesitate to look at species that do not directly give rise to the hominid cell line. But if you want to talk about the human brain, you have to talk about the evolution of so-called hominids and hominines, which branched off from primate cell lines and various organs and organisms to give rise to this remarkable structure that we have. When I say a remarkable structure, I mean that, for example, the wrinkled structure you see in pictures of the brain, the cerebral cortex, is if you unwound it and place it on a table, it would be the size of a large table napkin. It would have at least 30 billion nerve cells or neurons and 1 million billion connections. If you counted one connection per second, you just finished counting them 32 million years later. That doesn't even take account of the ways in which they can interact. So it's a most remarkable structure. And, of course, we want to understand how it operates. We want to understand how its parts interact, how they account for the various sensory modalities like sight, like touch, like smell, like even some subtle things like balance. And so that is one of the things a theory has to account for. It also has to account not only for evolution, but for the development of the brain. For example, from a fertilized egg, and here's the miracle of it, you watch the cells develop, multiply, roll up into a tube called the neural tube, give rise to nerve cells, and finally give rise to the thing I was talking about, the cerebral cortex, amongst other regions of the brain. All of this has got to be developed by a theory, and the theory that I have developed takes account of both development and also of behavior and how behavior modifies development. Finally, it takes account of the fact that if you don't think the brain is a computer, you must, of course, account for how it nonetheless coordinates things, gives spatio-temporal coordination, correlation, and cause.
Let's talk about the interaction between the brain and the environment. What happens, I mean, after a person or an ape or whatever is born and they're young, how do interactions with the environment, languages learned, music heard, physical activities, how do these affect the brain?
Or even give rise to some of its, help give rise to some of its structures. Let's start with the fact that the key element of the brain is neuroanatomy, the way in which the brain is hooked up, the specific ways that one part of the brain hooks up to the other. Now, that hookup comes through some structures called synapses, and the nerve cells give rise to electrical currents, which will release components into a synapse, which is a connection between a presynaptic neuron and a postsynaptic neuron, in such a way as to stimulate the postsynaptic neuron to fire or not to fire. Neurons come in two flavors, excitatory and inhibitory. And the interesting thing about the synapse, the connections, is that those synapses are plastic, they're malleable. That is to say, their strength depends upon what experiences you have, in direct answer to your question. So there are ways in which you will inhibit certain synapses and ways in which you'll stimulate others by increasing their strength. And that, of course, is a fundamental requirement of memory. So effectively, your behavior is constantly altering that structure I was talking about, the cortex, amongst other things, by changing its synaptic strengths. And those changes which are specific to your body are, of course, the critical ones. So that's the next point, which is that is what I call the behavioral trinity. The body, the brain is embodied, and the body and brain are embedded in the world. So your brain listens to your body and vice versa, and both of them listen to the environmental signals in such a way as to change the ways in which those synapses are strengthened or weakened. So the global theory that I've given rise to is based on one of Darwin's great principles, and we can talk about that if you'd like.
Yes, please.
All right. That principle is called population thinking. First thing, given everything I've said, is that no two individual brains finally are alike, especially for higher brains like ours. And the reason is, of course, what you said before, the environment is different for every single individual. Now, in a species, brains are quite similar, but if you look at the microanatomy and the ways in which individual neurons connect up through synapses with each other, there's an enormous amount of variation. You have to account for that variation. And Darwin accounted for it among species of different animals by the population thinking, which says that if you have a population of individuals, each one different than the others, and you encounter an environment under competitive pressure, some individuals will be more fit than others simply by the numbers involved. And they're the individuals who give rise to progeny that survive while the others will not. And the ones who survive, of course, will give their genes over into the gene pool, and the genes are the score. But the selection is on the individuals. So if the brain is not a computer, it doesn't work by logic directly or math straight, then how does it work? My theory, called neural Darwinism, or the theory of neuronal group selection, says that the brain, just like evolution, is a selectional system. That is to say, it works in the following way. When you form the brain and its anatomy by development, you cause an enormous amount of variation. And then you select those processes which give rise to effective responses to the signal inputs. That's called developmental selection. Overlapping that is the interaction with the environment that you mentioned, and that changes synaptic strengths, and that's called experiential selection. The third part of the theory, which is the one that accounts for coordination and spatiotemporal coordination, is the hardest idea, and I don't know if I can express it easily in words, but it's sort of like this, that the anatomy of the brain exists in maps, and those maps are connected by particular structures called axons, which are projections of neurons. For example, in your brain as a female, you have about 100 million more of such axons connecting the right and left half of your brain than are present in mine, obviously accounting for female superiority, right?
I don't know either.
But I know that there are a couple of 100 million of them at least called the corpus callosum. And every 10 milliseconds, 10,000th of a second, one of those neurons in the millions, hundreds of millions, fires. That connects equivalent areas of one side of your brain to the next. And the idea of reentry, which is the idea that's the hard one, says that there's massively parallel connections of that type, which then couple up by changing synaptic strengths so as to give synchronous responses, so that circuits are selected in terms of synchrony to give the kind of responses that are valuable. Now, there's one other principle I haven't mentioned. That is all occurring during the individual's lifetime and development. But I haven't mentioned that for a species, there are systems in the brain called value systems, which give you either positive or negative reward, or absence of reward. One example is the so-called locus coeruleus, the little blue spot, which responds to loud noises, for example, by releasing neurotransmitter substances that change whole regions of synaptic strengths, not just an individual synapse. There's another one called the dopaminergic system, which has a neurotransmitter called dopamine, which is responsible for rewarding you when you learn successfully. So the idea is that there are three tenets: developmental selection, experiential selection, and reentry, under the cogent constriction and restraint of value systems. And that is the theory. Complicated, isn't it?
It is, and it's all basically based on mechanisms that make our survival more likely.
I should hope so, especially on radio programs like this.
You take on the question of consciousness and this jump between biomechanical processes on the one hand and the experience of being alive, of having imagination and emotion,
What it's like to be you, or what it's like to be me, or what it's like, as they say, to be a bat.
Exactly. I mean, we don't experience ourselves as bundles of synapses and axons and neurons.
Not. We have what's called phenomenal experience. In other words, what it's like to be. So one of the mysteries philosophers have wrestled with is, how do you account for that? Well, we have been developing theories at the Institute to deal with this question. And we feel that since the brain is a selectional structure, any explanation of consciousness has to take account of that selection. One of the most extraordinary things about consciousness is the extraordinary variety. So let's talk about it for a minute, and then we'll come back to the phenomenal experience, what it's like to be. Let's say one of the most remarkable things about consciousness is that our activities and experience of phenomenal experience, all of that is extremely well integrated. That is to say, for example, hold up your index finger, and if I say, be conscious only of that, you couldn't do it. You're conscious of it, you're conscious of your hand, you're conscious of the seat you're sitting on, you're conscious of noise in the background in the cafeteria, you're conscious of my voice. All of this is integrated in a remarkable way in periods of fractions of a second to seconds, correct? The second thing is that while it's integrated, it's also enormously changeable and gives rise to an enormous number of discriminations or distinctions. Those distinctions are, in our opinion at the Institute, just what the philosophers call qualia, the quality of pain, of redness, of warmth, of whatever, and also of a whole scene, whatever that scene is that I've just talked about.
Right.
So the problem is, how do you study the first-person qualia at the same time you're trying to explain the third-person mechanisms that we were talking about before, correct? That's your question, essentially.
Right.
How do you account for it? Well, the first thing is this. No scientific theory, by simple description, can give you a sense of, say, you are a very hyper-intelligent Martian, of what warmth is. You have to have a body and a brain like ours, which are both embedded in the world. But every one of those experiences that you have as a subjective first-person individual, all of those experiences have accompanying discriminations which we can study in terms of report and third-person measurement. So the idea is to develop a theory for consciousness which will account for the discriminations, respect the fact that there's phenomenal experience that you can only have if you have a body, and not be impeded by that. Sometimes people question this and say, no, that doesn't make sense. But there are questions in science that you can answer without having these ultimate philosophical distinctions answered in a way that would be scientifically satisfactory. I'll give you an example from physics. Leibniz's question, why is there something rather than nothing? Well, with all due respect to quantum mechanicians, I don't think we know the answer to that for certain. That doesn't stop the advance of physics. So the fact that we don't have a simple way in words of explaining what warmth is doesn't mean that we can't study it. So, if you want to know what the connection is to a theory of neural Darwinism for consciousness,
right,
that sometimes in the, here we come back to evolution, sometime perhaps 250 million years ago, a new kind of neural circuit evolved in development, which connected the posterior parts of the brain, which dealt with sensory modalities like vision and touch and what have you. It connected those perceptual parts of the brain to memorial parts, parts that dealt with memory in the more anterior portions. And it did that connection by making a reentrant circuit so that, for instance, the occipital or visual part of the brain is actually back and forth, signaling back and forth with the frontal part of the brain. Now, that part of that theory has already been validated by some experiments we've done measuring magnetic circuits of the brain, and more recently in France by a group of people who measured by looking at patients and measuring with single electrodes the connection between the posterior parts and the anterior parts. So to sum it up, the theory has to account for how you have the integration and how you have the discrimination. And we think we're well on the way to doing that.
What is the difference in consciousness between, let's say, a frog and a human being? Can you characterize that?
Only with words, because we don't know what it's like to be a frog, do we?
Well,
we do know that the neural circuits, how do I say it? What the frog's eye tells the frog's brain is a very famous paper. A frog will send out its tongue to capture an insect. It will also hunker down if you have a looming threat or a shadow. And those are behavioral traits that have been selected as a result of these neuronal responses. But the idea of saying, do I know whether a frog is conscious like a human being? No. The evidence looks like not very likely. And I'll tell you one of the reasons. The one thing we do know about studying consciousness is very useful, is that the human being is the only organism we know has high, what I call higher order consciousness in the extreme degree. Now, what do I mean? What I've been talking about before is what I'll call primary consciousness, the ability to experience warmth and heat and scenes, etc. But it doesn't have any element of the kind we have, because what happened in our evolution is we invented language. And once we had language, we're no longer stuck with just the interaction with the real world. We have Alice in Wonderland, we have schizophrenia, we have physics, we have this discussion. And at that point, we have higher order consciousness. We're no longer entrained only to the scene outside. Our memory involves tokens of speech which have meaning. And once that's the case, of course, the whole story has changed enormously. So effectively, in a curious way, human beings are the best possible agents to study when you want to study consciousness, because they can report. And you can check their reports and doing experiments on their brains to see if they are consistent or not. So I can't answer your question what it's like for a frog or whether it's conscious, but I can answer the question reasonably affirmatively that you are.
other animals have language to some extent, or another.
Yes.
Dolphins, whales, chimps,
yes,
prairie dogs. Is it a matter of degree,
or
is there a qualitative difference between our and their consciousness?
The answer is both. The answer is the following. Without a question, the experiments with chimps suggest that as primates, they have not only primary consciousness, but the certain semantic aspects, meaningful aspects of higher order consciousness. But they don't have syntax, so they can't, in a recursive fashion, fasten endless numbers of sentences and narratives, okay?
Right.
They can ask for things using the syntax, but they can't string it along. There's no chimp Shakespeare around, all right? But in our case, we have syntax as well as semantics, and that enables us to do an infinite number of sentences and meanings, endless in a way. And so while it's continuous, there really is a big change once we acquired language.
There is a very great variety of, I would think, of human brains across populations, just the way there's a high variety of other characteristics across populations, whether it be human or other species. Is that, you would think of that in a pretty much in a Darwinian way? If you have a population, different skills and different abilities will be there to be drawn on for survival purposes?
Yes, indeed, but I would be very careful not to explain human behavior entirely as a function of evolutionary psychology. Sometimes some people are tempted to do that and say, you know, when we climbed down from the trees, our precursors, and went into the savannas, left the females at home, etc., etc., that will account for why certain human individuals perform a certain kind of act. I much doubt that. While those histories provide a constraint, the answer to your question is, of course, the brain is so plastic and remarkable that culture and the forces of culture and requirements of survival that occur within history makes for an enormous variety of human behavior and for the complexity of human interactions. So the brain, in short terms, not in evolutionary time, is capable of an enormous number of distinctions, as you can see by watching TV or trying to understand history.
Well, I suppose the great variety of culture shows that. I mean, you know, I was thinking about reading about the effect of the environment on the brain. The effect of the brain on the environment is just as great or greater.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the amount of concrete we've poured over the world since, I don't know, let's say the Middle Ages,
right,
you have an idea. Why do we have to worry about CO2 and warming? We have to worry because we can modify the environment enormously. Now, coming back to evolution, by the way, evolution selects individuals in general that are on the average fitter so that they can procreate, right? Natural selection, Darwin's great theory, is really differential reproduction. Now, the fact is, though, most selection of an evolutionary type occurs on the breeding age, right?
Right.
And after the breeding age, well, culture makes a big play. Maybe we have some effect, us old men, because of our economic contribution to our children's tuition. But evolution is not selecting on that directly.
Right.
It selects for progeny. And so it's a very complex situation in which evolution provides strong constraints, but individual history fills in the picture.
To what extent are you studying live brains in action, and to what extent are you studying cadavers?
No, no. We're not here studying cadavers. We did that. I did that in medical school. But
right.
No, what we are studying is, for example, at the Institute, we're studying fruit flies because there's a very interesting thing we've discovered, which is that fruit flies sleep, insects sleep, so we can do the genetics of sleep on flies. The second thing we can do, we can even look at fly aggression and how male flies fight over who has the right to seduce a female. And we also work on rats, learning in mazes in portions of the brain. For example, one of the portions of the brain is known as the hippocampus, which is responsible for converting short-term into long-term memory. We actually measure the, as rats traverse a maze or solve a problem, we measure the electrical currents with electrodes, microelectrodes in the brain. So we have a rather wide range of that kind. And finally, what we do, of course, is look at gene products and molecules having to do with neurotransmission and a variety of other things related to this dopaminergic system that I talked about. So there's a very wide range of studies required to fully understand what's going on.
You've written about the divide between science and the humanities. How did this come about, and what is lost to us in academia, in the world, by having this divide?
Well, the classic picture has been of a divide, the so-called two cultures theory. I don't know if you know about that. Right. Snow, the scientist, the English scientist, C.P. Snow, who said there are two cultures and it's a sort of tragedy, they don't speak to each other, etc., etc. Of course, science has become increasingly dominant. So you people who study art history and English majors have had to defend themselves perhaps only by differential comparisons. But my own belief is that there's not a conflict at all, that in effect science looks at an enormously complicated environment and world and even human interactions. And whenever, and here we come back to your metaphors, whenever you have an idea which is fruitful but nonetheless slightly ambiguous, if you can clean it up by doing experiments and doing measurements and being very careful about thinking and controls and logic, that's fine. You can do science. But there are aspects of our nature that are not reducible in that way, one of which would be, for example, a whole body of poetry, correct?
Right.
If I said that I'm in the evening of my life using that metaphor, you know exactly what I mean. But if you were literal about it, you'd wrinkle your nose and say, evening, what has that got to do with you? You're not a day. So the interesting thing is that the history of each brain is sort of as irreversible as the history of the whole human race. And therein lies an interesting intersection. In other words, the creativity for science can come from many different sectors, including those of art and including those of the humanities. Vice versa. So I don't have what you might call a strong reductionist position. I do not believe that everything can be reduced to scientific description. Part of that has to do, of course, with the accession of language. Once you have language and ambiguity and suggestiveness and associativity, you have a different story entirely, don't you?
Right. Well, let's get back to where we started, which is this question of metaphor. I mean, I think that people who are not scientists are more satisfied by metaphors and more interested in them, whereas, as you said at the beginning, a lot of metaphors, although they're close, are not actually good scientific theory, and we have this model of the brain as a kind of computer, or the internet as a kind of model of the brain. What are some of the problems with those metaphors?
Well, I'll get to that in a minute, but let me say something about metaphor. First of all, I think one of the earliest processes of higher brains is thinking and metaphor. Second of all, I think that the idea of starting off absolutely precisely is absurd, because once you're very precise, you're also rigid. Whereas when you have, how should I say, some degree of ambiguity and metaphor, it's suggestive. And the reason is that our brains don't have lookup tables like a computer. They don't have fetch addresses. Our memory doesn't work that way. It's not at all like computer memory. And so we have to have associativity. It's very important to associate one thing with another. By the way, that's true in consciousness, the function of the structures giving rise to consciousness, probably related to planning. I'll come back to that. But repeat your question now in terms of, I wouldn't make the distinction, for example, that somehow because they don't have the precision of science, people working in English literature aren't as intelligent. That doesn't make sense to me at all.
No. Just more the question about what works and doesn't work with the internet and computer metaphors for
yes,
the brain.
Good. Okay, let's start there. First of all, the brain, if you look at the detailed anatomy of the brain and how it develops with this individuality and variance, no computer would survive that degree of variation in its wiring structure, number one. Number two, the fact is that the system is a selectional system, not an instructional system. Computers work by syntactical instructions. You're told precisely what to do. They're called Turing machines, after the great British mathematician who wrote a theorem about this. Brains do not work that way. And so the metaphor is a weak one, to say the least, and sometimes misleading. The second thing is that the Internet is certainly a rich and metaphorical and complex and ambiguous structure altogether and constantly growing. But the usefulness of that metaphor as such in precisely understanding how the brain works escapes me, and maybe there's somebody out there who has a better view of it, but I don't quite see how you can make that comparison directly.
I think the only comparison that I've heard that I thought was interesting was, for example, if somebody has a brain injury, they can, through a different set of circuits, they can rebuild in the same way that if one computer is down, the Internet sends its messages through a different channel.
Okay, let's talk about that. That's a subject I've contributed to. And the basic idea is an idea called degeneracy. Sounds awful, doesn't it? Degeneracy means that different structures can give you the same function, okay? Different structures can give you the same function and the same output. To give you a feeling for that in a much more precise way than the one you've just stated about the Internet, the genetic code that is behind all of the genetic instructions for all organisms, the genetic code is degenerate. That is to say, there are triplet codons, so-called, of bases. 64 different varieties of combinations of four different bases in triplets. So UUU equals phenylalanine. But if I change the third position, the third U, to one other base like G, it doesn't change anything about the output. So if you make a string of them, that gives a string of so-called amino acids or proteins that are responsible for the shape of your body and the function of your body. There's a huge number of different sequences of the so-called RNA triplets, which give the rise to the same exact order of one single stretch of polypeptides and a protein. Now, degeneracy is also a term used in mathematics. It's also used in quantum mechanics. But in biology, degeneracy is everywhere. No two of your cells are alike identically. There are many, many different sneak pathways, and that's the essence of neural Darwinism, that you have many, many different ways and you select those that happen to function. So if one goes out, the next one gets used. You have sneak paths everywhere. And sort of without having, let's say it this way, an engineer under constraint of his profit-sharing colleagues, the profit motive itself, cannot build degenerate structures. What he builds is something quite precise and hopefully economically useful. Evolution, not being intelligent in that way, but enormously powerful, builds enormous numbers of degenerate structures. So if one of them fails, the other one produces it. Now, the important idea is this, that degeneracy is not the same as, redundancy.
Right.
For example, if I send up five computers in a space shuttle, and I'm using two, and one breaks down, I just whip in another one from the remaining three, right? But it's not degenerate because its structure is identical. Degeneracy can functionally do the same thing as redundancy, but it provides an enormous degree of variation from which you can choose. And therefore, you don't have to specifically design in an exact counterpart.
Right.
See what I'm saying? Am I making sense?
Yes, yes.
So, the Internet, of course, in the sense of ambiguity of language and motive, is also degenerate. There are many different ways in which you can say the same message, hopefully not an insult.
Right. In Buddhist theory of mind, and I'm asking this because Buddhist teachings have explored the nature of mind in a very rigorous way for a long time, consciousness proceeds and continues past the death of the body. Is such a theory compatible with any extant scientific theory of mind?
I'm afraid not.
That's what I thought.
Well, that's all right. Take solace in the fact that while you're here, it's been a splendid trip.
I'd like to thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
All right. Thank you, Marie Charlotte. I appreciate your comments.
Thanks so much.
All the best.